For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's January the 5th. We are in Parashas Mishpatim. We're in Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23. We're about to start it. Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Yeah, I'm sorry, page 432. 432 and 433. Yeah. Okay, the verse says, Lo sisa shem ashav, which we're going to read the English translation, do not accept a false report. Al tasha siyatcha im rasha lios et chamas, which, again, they translate, do not extend your hand with the wicked to be a... We'll say a false witness.
Yeah.
Okay. The first clause of Lo Sisa Shema Shav, do not accept a false report, has several different meanings, all of which are accepted by the Gemara as being accurate, and therefore they're all true. The simple meaning is the judge should not accept a false report, which means that make sure the witnesses are telling the truth. Don't accept the report of the witness if it's false. That may be true, but the Gemara understands there's a deeper command being made over here of the judges. And that is that don't accept the report of the witnesses in a manner that will bias you towards what they're saying. Of the litigants. Don't accept the report of the litigants in a manner that will bias you towards one of them. And therefore, the Gemara says, based on this verse, that a judge may not listen to the side of the story of one of the litigants without the other one present. Meaning, if the court case is ready to commence and one litigant is there and the other one is not, the judge may not hear the first litigant's side. He has to wait until they're both there, because in the presence of the person with whom you're having the fight, you're going to present your side differently. When you know that the other side knows that you're lying, you'll be much more careful in what you say. And it changes how a person makes a presentation. Therefore, the judge is not allowed to hear one side of the argument before the other side is there. Not only that, but when they're both there in front of him, the rule is the judges sit, the litigants stand. The judge is not allowed to allow one of the litigants to sit and the other one to stand. Because if one litigant feels that the other one is being given preferential treatment, then it will make it more difficult for him to present his side. He will believe that the judge is already biased against him and will not make a presentation in the proper way. Yeah.
Is he allowed to make both of them sit?
If one of them cannot stand, he can allow both to sit. But the proper way to do it is they both stand and the judges sit. That's the proper way to do it. Yeah.
Does bribery fit in here?
No, because there are specific psukim about bribery. But we'll have that very clearly later on. Now, included in this as well is, even though we're talking about judges, but whenever we hear someone speaking about somebody else, we become the judge of what we're hearing. And therefore, we also derive from here the prohibition against listening to Lashon Hara, or accepting Lashon Hara, accepting an evil report about somebody else. Meaning that one is not allowed, as we know, one is not allowed to speak Lashon Hara. One is not allowed to speak evil about another person, about another Jew. That is prohibited. And that prohibition we will find later on. But the listener as well is prohibited. One is not allowed to listen to Lashon Hara. But sometimes you hear it inadvertently. You don't realize that the speaker is going to speak Lashon Hara, and now they've said the words, and the words have entered your ears. You've heard from the person already that so-and-so is a scoundrel. So once you hear those words, we are prohibited to accept the words. What does it mean to accept the words? To believe the words. We're not allowed to believe Lashon Hara. So that if someone is speaking Lashon Hara, meaning that what they're saying fits the parameters of the prohibited speech of Lashon Hara, then we, the listeners, are not allowed to believe it as true. In a case where we are being warned about potential danger, then we are allowed, and not only are we allowed, we should take steps to protect ourselves in case it might be true. So if the person is telling us, you need to be careful, so-and-so is a thief, and if you go near him, you may end up losing your wallet, so then we should take steps to be careful, either not to go near that person, or when we're near that person, to keep our hand on our wallet. But if it's not something which is meant to protect us, and even if it is meant to protect us, we don't have to believe it as being 100% true. We can just simply take steps to protect ourselves, but not make up our minds that so-and-so is a thief. But certainly, if it has nothing to do with protecting ourselves, the person just says, so-and-so is a scoundrel. With nothing to do with us, we don't have interactions with that person, he's not saying it to protect us, then we're not allowed to believe it as true. We have to make up in our minds that the person speaking is, at best, mistaken, and at worst, a liar. And is we should cast aspersions upon what they are saying in our minds. We say what they're saying is not true. This is an important factor in general when it comes to Lashon Hara. It's an often overlooked point that even if you end up hearing Lashon Hara, you can't believe it. So if we hear things about people and it's evil and we're not supposed to be hearing it in the first place, we're not allowed to believe it is true. This is an effective tool for a teacher or a parent when a student or a child comes forth and reports about another student or child, when it's not a situation where one is in danger, where it's just reporting something the other person did, which is wrong. The person who's in a position of authority it is appropriate to teach that it is wrong to speak Lashon Hara. So the parent or the teacher can say that, you know, what you just said is Lashon Hara, it's inappropriate speech. But then if the parent and teacher acts upon what was said, then the message is lost. So that if one child comes and tells the parent, so-and-so is taking cookies from the cookie jar, no one's getting hurt, nothing's being broken, but so-and-so is doing a wrong thing. They're taking cookies from the cookie jar. So the parent says to the other child, you shouldn't tell me that because it's Lashon Hara, but then goes and reprimands the child for taking the cookies from the cookie jar, well, then the message is lost because you went ahead and acted upon what happened. The best way to react in such a situation is to tell the child, I'm sorry, I can't believe you. That's Lashon Hara. Therefore, I'm prohibited. I can't believe what you're saying. No, but he's saying, go look. I'm sorry, I can't believe it. And that's it. Just let it go. Better the other child should take cookies from the cookie jar rather than this child should learn that Lashon Hara is acceptable. It's better to teach that Lashon Hara is unacceptable than it is to stop the child from taking cookies from the cookie jar. So it is important to teach that we are not allowed to believe Lashon Hara. We're not just not allowed to speak it and listen to it, but we're also not allowed to believe it. That's derived from here. Do not accept a false report. A Lashon Hara should be considered a false report. We're not to accept it. We're not to accept it as true. Better, you get the better of two evils. Let it go. I'd much rather the child eat cookies all night long rather than this child speak Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is much worse than eating cookies out of turn.
So let's say something else, maybe a little more dangerous.
So if it's dangerous, it's different, because dangerous is not Lashon Hara. So once we get to a situation where something is dangerous, then it's appropriate to tell about it. Then it's not Lashon Hara anymore. It's only when it is purely Lashon Hara that it is not allowed to be believed.
It's hard for a child to determine whether
if the child thinks it's dangerous, that's one thing. But usually what's going on over there is that the kid is jealous, so the other one's getting cookies and they're not. So they're.
But you were referring to a judge before.
Yeah.
Litigants.
Yeah.
But litigants do say things about each other that could be true.
Yeah, so in a court case, it is permitted to, because the whole point over there is to decide who's right and who's wrong, and it is permitted for one litigant to say the other litigant, to say about the other one what they did, because I want to get my money back. The person has my money. That's a perfectly legitimate situation to tell over something, because I'm in front of a person who can do something about it. We're in court. That is the place, that's the appropriate place to do it. But I need to leave out the character assessments. He stole my money, yes. That scoundrel stole my money. I got to leave out the...
Yeah,
yes.
This thing, in general, is better than telling a child, I don't want to hear Lashon Hara. You could say to the child, you know what? I like to hear good things about your
friend. Yeah, that's the positive way to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. But I have a different...
Yes.
Also,
go ahead.
It's like, I understand what you're saying, and I agree to a certain extent, but, you know, you're saying, so what if a kid has, a few cookies, no big deal? The thing is that you're teaching the child it's okay to take without permission. So it's like, okay, so if I take this and I don't have permission for it, I take something, I'm not getting yelled at. Mommy knows about it, and I'm not getting yelled at. So then I can take something else.
Yes, yes,
and
you're right.
Family.
You're right, you're right. I still argue one is better than the other. But even so, a smart parent is later on going to, when the first child has removed himself from the situation, is going to go peek into the kitchen and move the cookie jar or do something. A smart parent is going to take care of the situation in another way. But not to base it on this report. That's all. That's all. So we have to not accept false reports. That goes for a judge and for ourselves in accepting Lashon Hara. And the second half of the statement is, as we said, not to extend your hand to the wicked to be a false witness. So this is the prohibition against accepting false testimony. Against believing false testimony, when you have a person, a Rasha, is not able to be a witness. It is from here that we learn that a person who has managed to get the title of Rasha, of evil, he is not an acceptable witness. How does one achieve that title of Rasha? So, for instance, a convicted thief is no longer able to testify in court for anybody else. Now, let's be very careful over here. When we say testify in court, we have to be very careful how it works with a Jewish court of law and a secular court of law. Remember, in a Jewish court of law, you only have three types of people in the court. You have the judge, you have the litigant, and you have a witness. Those are the three different types of people. A Rasha, someone who is evil, meaning a convicted thief, that's an example of a Rasha, a convicted thief, is not able to be a judge and not able to be a witness. But he can be a litigant. Someone may wrong a Rasha. Someone who is a Rasha, someone who is a convicted thief, might still need to come to court because someone else has done something to him, and he has every right to go to court about that. So he has every right to be a litigant, and he can be believed when he speaks about his own situation and he's making his claim to the judge about this other person. There, what he says is acceptable. What he can't do is act as a witness on behalf of somebody else. His testimony on behalf of somebody else is unacceptable in court because he has been branded a Rasha, because he has been convicted of stealing. Why is it that someone has been convicted of stealing, why would he be a Rasha and therefore not be accepted as a witness in court? Because a person who has stolen money, taken money that is not his, is obviously has a weakness for money, and if he has a weakness for money, then his testimony can be bought as well, which means that one of the litigants could pay him to claim that he saw something that he actually didn't see. So once we find out this person is willing to take money that's not his own, then we are suspicious that he may also testify about something which isn't true. But if he's a person who has committed a different type of sin, let's say this person has been convicted of eating something they shouldn't eat, they are still permitted to testify in court because that's not branded as a Rasha, meaning a Rasha regarding money. And that's what we're concerned about over here. Rasha de Hamas, and a Rasha, someone who's evil, regarding money, we suspect that his testimony may be bought and that's why he is ineligible to testify in court. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Lo siya acharei rabim lero. So we're going to read the English in the art school as well, because this pasuk needs to be dissected. Lo siya acharei rabim lero. Do not be a follower of the majority for evil. Velo sane al riv, and do not respond to a grievance. Lintos acharei rabim lahatos, by yielding to the majority to pervert the law. So, if you take it at face value, it is the verse is saying, don't follow the majority when the majority is saying something wrong, is doing something wrong. Which means that even though we have a rule, the majority rules, we follow majority, but that's only when the majority is acting properly. When the majority is clearly doing something which is incorrect, then we forsake the majority. So the Gemara here, the Talmud, dissects this verse to tell us several important matters regarding the conduct of a court. First of all, again, let's make sure we understand. In a Jewish court of law, as opposed to a secular court of law, we don't have a jury. The judges are themselves the ones that vote on the case. A regular court case, we'll call it normal regular court case, has a panel of three judges, and they vote. So obviously, 2-1, the majority wins. 3-0, a unanimous vote, obviously the three wins. But you have a 2-1 majority win. In a more serious crime, like a capital crime, then it's a panel of 23 judges. And again, the majority would win. And in a very, very important type of case, there, in very specific types of cases, you need a panel of 71 judges. That's the Sanhedrin of 71 judges. So either 3, 23, or 71. When you have a panel of 3, so that's for all financial matters, monetary matters, it's a panel of 3 and a 2-1 margin of victory. So if you and I go to court and we state our claims to the judges, and two of the judges side with you and one of them sides with me, well, then you win the case. And if it's the other way around, if two side with me and one side with you, then I win the case. Very simple. When you need a panel of 23 in a capital crime, then there's a special rule in the Torah, which is as follows. If 12 judges rule that the defendant is innocent and 11 rule that he is guilty, well, the majority wins and he is innocent and he goes free. If 12 rule that he is guilty and 11 rule that he is innocent, we do not put him to death. We do not put to death on the basis of a margin of one judge. If 13 judges say that he is guilty and 10 say that he is innocent, we'll put him to death. That's 13-10 in favor of death, of guilt, we'll put him to death. But 12-11, we will not. That's derived from the first line of this pasuk, of this verse. Lo siya acharei rabim liraos. Do not follow the majority for evil. Now, this can't mean don't follow any majority for evil, because then how would we ever put anybody to death? If this means that even if it's 21-2 in favor of guilt, if it would mean even in that case we wouldn't put him to death, then we're never going to put him to death. Clearly, there has to be a situation where we're going to put him to death. So therefore, the sages understand that this verse is not referring to any type of majority. It's referring to a slim majority, a majority of only one. We will not put him to death. So it's 12-11. We will not put him to death. If it's 12-11 in favor of innocence, then he will go free. Now, what happens if it's 12-11 in favor of guilt? We can't put him to death. But on the other hand, you can't say he's innocent because the majority said he's guilty. So what do you do with him? So in that situation where it's 12-11 in favor of guilt, the based in the court brings in two more judges. You don't bring in one. You always have to have enough that it's odd, an odd number, so that it's never a split What's that?
Tied.
Tied, yeah. Hey, hung, it's not a jury, but yeah. So you shouldn't have it tied. So you always bring in two. So they bring in two judges. And now let's see what happens to those two judges. If those two judges, remember, it was 12 to 11 in favor of guilt, you bring in two more judges. If those two judges rule in favor of innocence, well, you now have 13 to 12 in favor of innocence. So he goes free. If the two judges that you brought in rule in favor of guilt, you now have 14 to 11 in favor of guilt. You can put them to death, because it's not a majority of one anymore, it's a majority of three. And if those two new judges split, so now you have 13 to 12 in favor of guilt, then you bring in two more. Right? And you continually bring in two more until both of them side one or the other. And once they side one or the other, then you would you'd know what to do. The alternative is that if one of the judges who has already ruled will change their mind, that could also happen. That they are convinced that they made a mistake and they switch their vote from innocent to guilty or guilty to innocent, then again you would also be able to change the ruling. But you can't put him to death on the majority of one. You have to have a majority of, it comes out three, because it's always uneven, so it's going to be either one, three, five. So you're going to have a majority of three to put him to death, not a majority of one. Yeah, sorry.
I'm lost. All these cases have to do with either death or freedom?
This case, the case where we won't rule guilt with a majority of one, is only a capital crime, only death. Any other crime, we will rule guilt on the majority of one. Yeah. Yes.
What I keep thinking is that it's interesting, when you bring the two new judges, do all of the judges then hear the case all over again?
Yeah.
When you're trying to judge people, you get clues from how they look and how they say things and so on. So it's not they're not hearing the same thing.
Which means they may change. But also the other ones may change. I mean, you have no choice over here. You got to keep on. You don't go beyond 71. Once you get which is a lot of people. Once you get to 71, the Gemara says if it's 36 to 35 in favor of guilt, then the only choice you have is that somebody changes their vote, and they just go at it. 36 to 35, and they argue about it until someone comes around. Yeah.
When you do add the two, does everybody re-vote each time?
Yeah. Yeah. You're continually. And eventually you'll break it. But this is only with a capital crime. Only a capital crime. Yeah.
When did we stop using the Sanhedrin or the major courts?
So when we lost authority with the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash, the second temple, then we were under the control of foreign powers. And we didn't have the same autonomy to judge ourselves. But even before that, many years prior to the destruction of the Second Temple, the Sanhedrin stopped judging capital crimes. Because there were too many capital crimes going on. And they felt that they were no longer able to judge them properly. So at that point already, the situation had deteriorated significantly. The Romans were already exerting a lot of control over Israel, even prior to the destruction of the temple. And many years prior to the destruction, they already disbanded the Sanhedrin for capital crimes. They no longer judged them.
What do you mean there were too many people? Just so
there were more. As the Torah authority waned, so there were more and more people who weren't following the Torah, and there was more and more crime, more and more capital crime. So that's the first part of the verse. Don't go after the majority for evil means don't go after a slim majority for the death penalty. The next clause, v'lo sane al riv lintos, it says here, do not respond to a, now they say grievance because the word reeve means grievance, but reeve can also be read as rav. or teacher. Do not respond to the Rav, to the teacher, which means that the judges that are, you know, in every court, you have your senior judges and you have your more junior judges. You have those who are greater sages and those who are not as great. Lo sa'ne'a riv means that the lower level judges should not take issue with the higher level judges, which means that if the higher level judge has ruled such and such, then the lower level judge should not disagree with that. Well, that's a problem because we need every judge to rule independently how they see the situation and not be influenced by the other judges. Therefore, what we derive from here is that we are maskal min hatzad, which means that when the Sanhedrin rules, especially for a capital crime, they do not start with the most experienced, most learned sage offering his opinion first. That's not what they do. They start with the rookie, the new kid on the block, is the one who rules first. And then they move up in ascending order. That way, none of the lower level judges will change their opinion based on what the higher level judges say, which means as follows. It's acceptable for a lower level judge to change their opinion because they've been convinced otherwise, because the judge who has more experience points out something that the lower level judge didn't realize, didn't think of, and oh yeah, now I understand. That's okay. But they shouldn't change their mind solely based on the fact that something bigger than me said differently, and now they don't have the confidence to rule what they see, what they believe. We don't want that. So therefore, the lower level judges speak first, and then you move up to the higher level judges. And that way, the lower level judges are able to have an independent and confident ruling of their own prior to hearing what the others have to say. Now, once the others have said whatever they said, if the lower level judge says, oh, you know what, now that he said that, it makes sense to me. I didn't realize that point. That complexity eluded me when I first went through it. Now I understand better and I changed my opinion. That's okay. But we don't want him to be biased before he even opens his mouth. We want him to be able to say something based on his own assessment first before you get to the higher level judges. So that's derived from here. We don't want a situation where a person is forced to argue with someone bigger than him and he's not going to want to do it. He's going to be intimidated. We don't want intimidation in the courts. And so the lower level judges speak first. Yeah?
Do you not glorify it?
No. That's,
where are you?
Do not respond to a grievance, but we're changing the word grievance to rav.
Okay.
And then finally, acharei rabim v'hatos, which means you should follow the majority. Acharei rabim v'hatos, that means that normally we do follow the majority. It means we only don't follow the majority of one for guilt, but for innocence, we will follow the majority of one. So again, from this verse, we learn that we follow the majority generally. We do not follow the majority of one for guilt in a capital crime. And we begin from the lower level judges so that they can have an independent assessment and not be influenced by by those who are more learned than they are. And finally, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, V'dol lo sedar b'rivo, a poor person, it says here, do not glorify a destitute person in his grievance, meaning do not rule in favor of the poor just because they're poor. A judge has two conflicting possible influences. A judge might argue that I can't say that this wealthy, highly respected individual in the community is guilty. I don't want to say he's guilty because it's going to make him look bad. It's going to make the community look bad. How can I do that? A judge is not allowed to be biased in that way. But also, a judge might say, I have pity for the poor person. How could I rule against the poor person? They don't have any money anyway. Where are they going to pay for this if they're wrong? And therefore, the judge is predisposed to try to rule in favor of the poor person. And the Torah says you're not allowed to do that. The judge cannot rule based on pity, based on mercy. A judge has to say, what is the law? Once the law is determined, then we can be merciful after that. But you got to know what the law is. You can't be merciful in administering. The law is the law. And you got it. The judge's job is to say, this is what the law is. And if the law is the poor person is guilty, and the poor person owes $100,000 to the rich person, then that's the law. If that's what it is, that's what it is. Now, the fact that the poor person has no money to pay it, and what are we going to do about it, that's the next step. But you can't rule against the rich person just because the other person is poor. You got to rule correctly, and then figure out what to do after that. But even more than that, even today, for a monetary matter between Jews, we are required to go to a Jewish court of law. We're not allowed to take a grievance to a secular court of law if it's between Jews. If there's a grievance between Jew and non-Jew, then we go to a secular court. But between Jew and Jew, we're required to go to a Beis Din, to a Jewish court of law. So
we have that now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So therefore, these laws are still in effect. Now, the truth of the matter, though, is really what you're saying is still true, because even a Jewish court of law today, the Jewish judges are not confident about the law. The law is so intricate and complicated. It's very, very difficult in a financial matter to get it really correctly. And therefore, Jewish judges today do not even attempt to try and rule according to the letter of the law. Instead, they seek compromise, which is essentially arbitration. That's what a Jewish court of law today tries to do, unless it's an open and shut, obvious case of fraud or something like that. But generally speaking, when it's two parties and they each have a legitimate argument, the court of law will attempt to arrive at some sort of compromise. That's going to be the goal of the courts of law. Because in a financial matter, even in a court case where you're right and I'm wrong, and therefore I owe you money, but you are allowed to say, I'll accept a settlement. Right? You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to say, I forfeit the actual law and I'll take a settlement. You're allowed to do that too. So that's what they'll strive for. That's what they aim for in a Jewish court of law today. Pasuk, Dalet, verse 4. Ki sifka shor uyivcha o chamaro to'eh, hashev tishivenu lo. When you will encounter the ox of your enemy or his donkey wandering, you shall return it to him. So even though he is your enemy, but you have to return his lost object. If you find his ox or his donkey, you're still required to return the donkey or the ox to the individual, despite the fact that you don't get along with him. But there's still a mitzvah to return the lost object. Now this dovetails with the next pasuk, verse 5, pasuk A. Yisireh chamor sona'acha, when you see the donkey of your enemy, of the one that you hate, roveitz tachas masa'o, that he's crouching under his burden. The burden is too much for the donkey. The donkey can't handle the burden. The chadalta me'azov lo. Do you think that you will forsake him? Meaning you won't help him? No. Azov ta'azov imo. You shall help him. It says repeatedly, but you have to help him. Do not think that you can say, well, I don't like him, and therefore I'm not going to help him. One is not allowed to do that. If one sees that his donkey is staggering under his load, one is required to help him unload the donkey. We don't generally use donkeys as beasts of burden today, but the same would apply in any situation that you see that his car is he's having trouble. Whatever, you have to help. You're required to help, even though you don't like the person. Person doesn't like you. Doesn't make a difference. A fellow Jew, you have to help with the needs that they have, with lost objects or with a potential loss. This is where the donkey is staggering under the burden. There's the potential that the donkey will die from being overtaxed with carrying the burden, so he's going to suffer a loss of money. And the donkey dies, it's a significant financial loss. You have to help him out to prevent the significant financial loss. So if you see someone who you don't like, fellow Jew who you don't like, and they are about to incur a financial loss, but you can help them, you can save them, you are required to do that to save them from the loss. Two points. We'll do it backwards. First of all, at the very end of the verse, at the end of the pasuk, it says, Azov ta'azov imo. You shall help with him. So the Gemara says that, why does it say that? Because, let's say, I have my donkey, and it's staggering under the load, and you walk by, well, you're required to come help me. So you come, and you start unloading the donkey. And I say, you know what? You have a mitzvah to unload my donkey. I'm going to sip some lemonade. So the Torah says, no. Azov ta'azov imo. You help with him. But if he sits down and says, hey, it's your mitzvah, go ahead, then you say, shalom, and you leave. It's only if the owner is also putting in effort, then you're required to help out. But if the owner has decided to relax, you are not required to help out. So the question is, what does it mean, someone who you don't like, someone who you hate? I mean, after all, we have a mitzvah to love our fellow Jews. So what do you mean, someone who you hate? So the term to hate, which we don't usually use with a fellow Jew, is referring to a Jew who has done something for which you're allowed to hate him, which is rare. It's rare that a Jew does something that's so bad that you're allowed to hate him. But there are situations where a Jew may do something that you're allowed to hate him. What would be a case of a Jew that does something that you are permitted to hate him? That would be a Jew who is doing a sin that is well known to be a sin. And this Jew knows that it's a sin, knows that he's not supposed to do it, has been raised in a way that they should know better, do know better, and they do it anyway, and they don't care, and they know that everybody knows and they don't care. It's a public thing. So if a person acts and behaves in that way where they are clearly flouting the law and saying, I don't care about it, it's irrelevant to me, and they know better, then that is a situation where it is permitted to hate that Jew because they are acting in a manner that is dismissive of the Torah. Now, in today's day and age, we rarely have such a case because the vast majority of people who do not follow the laws of the Torah don't know better, weren't raised with it, and don't understand the importance of it. Here we're talking about someone who is well aware, was raised with it, has very little reason not to do it, and they're just saying, I don't feel like it. You know, they're just dismissing it. That's where it is permitted to hate the person. And the Torah is saying that even though it is permitted to hate the person, you still have to help the person out. It doesn't mean that you can just let their beast die under the burden. Now, this mitzvah is repeated later on in Parashas, I believe, Kisetze, all the way towards the end of the Torah. A very similar pasuk, but over there, there's a very significant difference. It doesn't say the donkey of the one who you hate. There it says the donkey of your friend. It doesn't say the donkey of the one that you hate. So one of the commentaries says that the reason why the Torah changes from the one that you hate to your friend is because this verse is prior to the sin of the golden calf. The Jews have not yet sinned of the golden calf. That verse, later on, is following the sin of the golden calf. And what this commentary says is that prior to the sin of the golden calf, then if a Jew would act in that sort of dismissive manner, well, then they have no reason to do that. And if they're acting that way, then you have the right to hate that person. But after the sin of the golden calf, as he writes, who's to say that we're any better than the other person? We've all done things wrong. We've all acted in manners that we shouldn't act. And therefore, he writes, it's not so simple to say that you hate a person because they do sins. And therefore, the Torah changes the phrase from the one who you hate to your friend. because we're all the same. Unfortunately, we do things that are not correct. We should do everything right, we don't. And therefore, we can't make this distinction of the one who I hate. Instead, we are all in the same boat. And we need to help each other out. The mitzvah is the same. The mitzvah is that we have to help each other out if we see that the other person is in need.
Yeah. I'm not saying this as a tree hugger, but in any case, the burden of this donkey, we're supposed to take care of animals. So
that is a discussion, the taking care of animals that you're referring to. There is a mitzvah called Tzar Balei Chaim, which means pain to animals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is a discussion whether there is definitely a law like that. The question is whether that's a Torah law or a rabbinic law. It is a matter of dispute. It is not fully accepted that it is a Torah law. It depends on how one understands it. So if you understand it's a Torah law, then yes, there would be a law to help out because of the animal. But otherwise, if it's a rabbinic law, then the Torah wouldn't be addressing it. It wouldn't be a Torah law. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Lo satem mishpat evyoncha berivo, do not, what's the word, pervert, the judgment of the destitute person in his grievance. This is the reverse of what we said before. Before we said, don't rule in favor of the poor person just because he's poor. If the law is that he's guilty, then he's guilty. This is the reverse. Don't take advantage of the poor person and rule against him because he's poor. You might say, well, it's easy to rule against him because he's poor. He has no resources and he has no way of defending himself and I don't need to care about him. No, says the Torah, you do need to care about him. Make sure that you do not pervert his judgment. It's very easy. A poor person is much easier to take advantage of than a rich person. He doesn't have resources. He generally doesn't have friends, or he doesn't have influential friends. And the Torah here is cautioning the judge to make sure that he gives the poor person a fair trial. And now we have a very famous pasuk, at least the first part of the pasuk, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. From words of falsehood, you should distance yourself. Fascinating, the Torah does not say, do not lie. Instead, the Torah says, from words of falsehood, distance yourself. It appears that the Torah is emphasizing to stay far away from words of falsehood. The Hashem does not like lies. He doesn't like it when people lie. He values emes, he values the truth. And therefore the Torah says, stay far away from lies. Don't just make sure you tell the truth, but stay distant from lies. And then it says, V'naki v'tzadik al taharog ki lo atzdik rasha. Do not execute the innocent or the righteous, for I shall not exonerate the wicked. That's what I just read in English. So do not put to death the innocent or the righteous, for I will not make the evil one righteous. Now this needs explanation, because who's the innocent and who's the righteous? I mean, don't put to death the wrong person. So is there an innocent person and a righteous person? Which one is it? So the Gemara tells us as follows. Again, this is a capital crime that we're talking about. If you have a person who has been judged, and after they've been judged, the ruling has been handed down, guilty or innocent. Then, after the court case is over, new evidence is brought before the court, which could overturn the previous judgment. Do we overturn the judgment or not? What do you think? Should we or shouldn't we overturn the judgment?
If you have no evidence, you should overturn it.
If you have new evidence, you should. Okay.
If it's the bad.
Yeah. Yes, if the verdict was to execute the person, then
okay.
It gives us the new evidence.
So the Gemara says, if the verdict was guilty and then new evidence presents itself, then we should try the case again and perhaps we'll change from guilty to innocent. If the verdict was innocent and new evidence presents itself, we should not try the case again. And therefore, the way that you read the verse is like this. that do not put to death the innocent or the righteous. Who's the innocent? The innocent is the person who was judged as guilty and now there's new evidence. Well, then you should try the case again. And if he comes out to be innocent, don't put him to death. So even though the original judgment was that he's guilty, but if there's new evidence which may prove him innocent, you need to try the case again and don't put him to death because he's really innocent. But then you have the righteous person. Who's the righteous person? That's the person who was righteous in court. In court, he was ruled to be righteous, that he was innocent. Now, new evidence presents itself. Maybe he's really guilty, says the Torah. No, once it's been pronounced in the court that he's righteous, do not try the case again. Now you'll say, but is that fair? What if he's really guilty? You have new evidence, which suggests that he's guilty. So that's where Hashem writes at the end of this verse, Ki lo atzdik rasha, I will not make righteous the evil person. Here, this is a very critical point in all of these court cases. Hashem says, let's not lose sight of the fact that I'm the one running the world, not you, and not the courts. Don't worry about it. At the end of the day, if he's really guilty, I'll take care of him. I'm God. I know the truth. And I can deal with it. And I don't need your help. So if he's really guilty, I'll take care of him. You need to follow the law. What's the law? The law is, if you ruled guilty and new evidence presents itself, try the case again. If you ruled innocent and new evidence presents itself, do not try the case again. But maybe he's guilty? Okay, I'll take care of it. I'm all right. I can handle it. That's what God is saying over here. I will not allow the righteous person to get away with it. But that's my problem, not yours. I will not allow... Right, I'm sorry. The one who you ruled as righteous, who is really guilty, that's right. Thank you. I will not let him get away with it. And then that's what Hashem says is his problem, not our problem to deal with. So here we have... This is just a critical point in understanding the way court cases work in a Torah view of law. We know we have to have courts, and the courts have to try cases. And you can't just throw up your hands and say, well, we don't know. You got to deal with it. And especially in financial matters, I mean, you got two people, somebody's right, somebody's wrong, you got to deal with it. And you have to handle it. Do we know for a fact that we're going to get it right every time? No, of course not. We're going to get it wrong sometimes. Courts make mistakes. The evidence can be flawed. The testimony can be flawed. The judges can be flawed. There's going to be mistakes. But nevertheless, the Torah requires us to set up a system of law, and you do the best you can. But Hashem says, but at the end of the day, I'm still in charge. Like, and I'm just telling you, I want you to have court systems set up. But at the end of the day, I'm going to handle it. If you award money to the wrong person, if Reuven owes Shimon $1,000, but you ruled that Shimon owes Reuven $1,000, so you took $1,000 away from Shimon and gave it to Reuven when you should have done the reverse. You should have taken $1,000 from Reuven and given it to Shimon. So now you've taken $1,000 from Shimon and given it to Reuven. Now Reuven really has $2,000 of Shimon's. So now what? Well, Hashem will have to take care of it. Somehow I'll have to make sure that $2,000 of Reuven ends up in Shimon's pocket. Will it happen today? Maybe not. Will it happen next year? Maybe not. Will it happen in this generation? Maybe not. Maybe it'll be their kids. But eventually, $2,000 of Reuven's family will go back to Shimon's family because that's what's really supposed to happen. Hashem's going to take care of it. But it doesn't absolve us from doing what we need to do. The judges have to try their best. And how do they try their best? By following the parameters of judgments that the Torah tells us. One of those parameters is that in a capital crime, we retry the case when the person was found to be guilty and there's new evidence. We do not retry the case if the person was found to be innocent and there's new evidence. That's one of the rules. And Hashem says, if it's a problem, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And let's do one more before we break because someone brought it up before. V'shochad lo sikach. Do not take a bribe. This is mentioned twice in the Torah. This is one of the two places. Do not take a bribe. Ki ha-shochad ye'aver pikhim. Because the bribery will blind the eyes of those who see, v'saleif divrei tzadikim, and will corrupt the words that are just. a person, if a judge takes a bribe, it will end up ruining his ability to be impartial. His judgments will end up being false. The Gemara tells us, even if he takes a bribe to judge properly, which means, let's say the judge already has decided that so-and-so is innocent, so-and-so is guilty. He's already heard the evidence, believes that one side is innocent, one side is guilty. And the one who is innocent says to the judge, here, take some of this, you know, he wants to, you know, take a little bit of money. He's trying to bribe him. The judge says, why can't I accept the bribe? I'm already going to rule in his favor. It has nothing to do with the money. Let me take the money. What difference does it make? So I'll pad my pockets a little bit. I'm going to rule in his favor anyway. This is not affecting my judgment at all. Says the Torah, no. It will affect the judge's judgment. The Torah says, the Gemara explains, that a judge who accepts a bribe, even if it is to judge correctly, but later in his life, he will lose the ability to judge properly. And he will end up corrupting justice. Never, ever take a bribe. A person who is a judge has to be as impartial as is humanly possible. It's not humanly possible to be completely, totally impartial, at least not for regular people. Moshe Rabbeinu was an exception. We learned about Shmuel was an exception. Most judges, it's very, very difficult to be 100% impartial, but as impartial as it can possibly be, a judge is required to do that, to be as impartial as possible. Thank you. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.